goes. A sigh escapes around the table. "Ah, that was beautiful," says Alicia. "Do it again." Claire is smiling in the dark.
"Not your usual," Mark says to Alicia.
"I'm too tired to concentrate and too pissed off."
"Because of Dad?"
"Yeah."
"Well, if you poke him, he's going to poke back."
Alicia pouts. Anybody can make an honest mistake.
"It sounded like Terry Riley for a minute there," I tell Alicia. She smiles.
"It was Terry Riley.
It was from Salome Dances for Peace." Claire laughs.
"How did Salome get into Silent Night?"
"Well, you know, John the Baptist, I figured that was enough of a connection. And if you transpose that first violin part down an octave, it sounds pretty good, you know. La, 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 la."
"But you can't blame him for getting mad," says Mark. "I mean, he knows that you wouldn't play something that sounded like that by accident."
I pour myself a second drink. "What did Frank say?" Claire asks.
"Oh, he dug it. He was, like, trying to figure out how to make a whole new piece out of it, you know, like Silent Night meets Stravinsky. I mean, Frank is 87. He doesn't care if I fuck around as long as he's amused. Arabella and Ashley were pretty snitty about it, though."
"Well, it isn't very professional," says Mark.
"Who cares? This is just St. Basil's, you know?"
Alicia looks at me.
"What do you think?"
I hesitate. "I don't really care," I say finally. "But if my dad heard you do that, he'd be very angry."
"Really? Why?"
"He has this idea that every piece of music should be treated with respect, even if it isn't something he likes much. I mean, he doesn't like Tchaikovsky or Strauss, but he will play them very seriously. That's why he's great. He plays everything as though he's in love with it."
"Oh."
Alicia walks behind the bar, mixes herself another drink, thinks this over.
"Well, you're lucky to have a great dad who loves something besides money."
I'm standing behind Claire, running my fingers up her spine in the dark. She puts her hand behind her back, and I clasp it.
"I don't think you would say that if you knew my family at all. Besides, your dad seems to care about you very much."
"No," she shakes her head. "He just wants me to be perfect in front of his friends. He doesn't care at all."
Alicia racks the balls and swivels them into position. "Who wants to play?"
"I'll play," Mark says.
"Henry?"
"Sure."
Mark and I chalk our cues and face each other across the table. I break, the 4 and the 15 go down.
"Solids," I call, seeing the 2 near the corner. I sink it and then miss the 3 altogether. I'm getting tired, and my coordination is softening from the whiskies.
Mark plays with determination but no flair and sinks the 10 and the 11. We soldier on, and soon I've sunk all the solids. Mark's 13 is parked on the lip of a corner pocket.
"8 ball," I say, pointing at it.
"You know, you can't drop Mark's ball or you'll lose," says Alicia.
"It's okay," I tell her.
I launch the cue ball gently across the table, and it kisses the 8 ball lovingly and sends it smooth and easy toward the 13. And it seems to almost detour around the 13 as though on rails, and plops decorously into the hole, and Claire laughs. But then the 13 teeters and falls.
"Oh, well," I say, "easy come, easy go."
"Good game," says Mark.
"God, where'd you learn to play like that?" Alicia asks.
"It was one of the things I learned in college, along with drinking, English, and German poetry, and drugs." We put away the cues and pick up the glasses and bottles.
"What was your major?" Mark unlocks the door, and we all walk together down the hall toward the kitchen.
"English lit?"
"How come not music?"
Alicia balances her glass and Claire's in one hand as she pushes open the dining room door. I laugh. "You wouldn't believe how unmusical I am. My parents were sure they'd brought home the wrong kid from the hospital."
"That must have been a drag," says Mark.
"At least Dad's not pushing you to be a lawyer," he says to Alicia. We enter the kitchen and Claire flips on the light.
"He's not pushing you either," she retorts. "You love it."
"Well, that's what I mean. He's not making any of us do something we don't want to do."
Was it a drag? Alicia asks me. I would have been lapping it up. Well, before my mom died, everything was great. After that, everything was terrible. If I'd been a violin prodigy, maybe, I don't know. I look at Claire and shrug. Anyway, Dad and I don't get along. At all.
How come?
Claire says, bedtime. She means, enough already. Alicia is waiting for an answer. I turn my face to her. Have you ever seen a picture of my mom? She nods. I look like her.
So?
Alicia washes the glasses under the tap. Claire dries. So he can't stand to look at me. I mean, that's just one reason among many.
But
Alicia, Claire is trying, but Alicia is unstoppable.
But he's your dad.
I smile. The things you do to annoy your dad are small beer compared with the things my dad and I have done to each other.
Like what?
Like the numerous times he has locked me out of our apartment in all kinds of weather. Like the time I threw his car keys into the river, that kind of thing.
Why'd you do that?
I didn't want him to smash up the car, and he was drunk. Alicia, Mark, and Claire all look at me and nod. They understand perfectly.
Bedtime,
says Alicia, and we all leave the kitchen and go to our rooms without another word except, good night.
It's 3:14 a.m. according to my alarm clock, and I am just getting warm in my cold bed when the door opens and Henry comes in very quietly. I pull back the covers and he hops in. The bed squeaks as we arrange ourselves.
Hi,
I whisper.
Hi,
Henry whispers back.
This isn't a good idea.
It was very cold in my room.
Oh.
Henry touches my cheek and I have to stifle a shriek. His fingers are icy. I rub them between my palms. Henry burrows deeper into the covers. I press against him, trying to get warm again.
Are you wearing socks? He asks softly.
Yes.
He reaches down and pulls them off my feet. After a few minutes and a lot of squeaking and shh, we are both naked.
Where did you go when you left church?
My apartment, for about 5 minutes, 4 days from now.
Why?
Tired. Tense, I guess.
No, why there?
Dunno. Sort of a default mechanism. The time travel air traffic controllers thought I would look good there, maybe.
Henry buries his hand in my hair. It's getting lighter outside.
Merry Christmas,
I whisper. Henry doesn't answer, and I lie awake in his arms, thinking about multitudes of angels, listening to his measured breath, and pondering in my heart.
In the early hours of the morning, I get up to take a leak, and as I stand in Claire's bathroom, sleepily urinating by the illumination of the Tinkerbell nightlight, I hear a girl's voice say, "Claire?" And before I can figure out where this voice is coming from, a door that I thought was a closet opens, and I find myself standing stark naked in front of Alicia.
"Oh,"
she whispers as I belatedly grab a towel and cover myself.
"Oh, hi, Alicia,"
I whisper, and we both grin. She disappears back into her room as abruptly as she came in.
I'm dozing, listening to the house waking up. Nell is down in the kitchen singing and rattling the pans. Someone walks down the hall past my door. I look over and Henry is still deep in sleep, and I suddenly realize that I have got to get him out of here without anyone seeing. I extricate myself from Henry and the blankets and climb out of bed carefully. I pick my nightgown up off the floor, and I'm just pulling it on over my head when Etta says, "Claire, rise and shine, it's Christmas," and sticks her head in the door. I hear Alicia calling Etta, and as I poke my head out of the nightgown, I see Etta turn away to answer Alicia, and I turn to the bed, and Henry is not there. His pajama bottoms are lying on the rug, and I kick them under the bed. Etta walks into my room in her yellow bathrobe, with her braids trailing over her shoulders. I say, "Merry Christmas," and she is telling me something about Mama, but I'm having trouble listening because I'm imagining Henry materializing in front of Etta.
"Claire?"
Etta is peering at me with concern.
"Huh? Oh, sorry. I'm still asleep, I guess.
There's coffee downstairs."
Etta is making the bed. She looks puzzled. I'll do that, Etta. You go on down. Etta walks to the other side of the bed. Mama sticks her head in the door. She looks beautiful, serene after last night's storm. Merry Christmas, honey. I walk to her, kiss her cheek lightly. Merry Christmas, Mama. It's so hard to stay mad at her when she is my familiar, lovely Mama. Etta, will you come down with me? Mama asks. Etta thwaps the pillows with her hands, and the twin impressions of our heads vanish. She glances at me, raises her eyebrows, but doesn't say anything. Etta?
Coming.
Etta bustles out after Mama. I shut the door after them and lean against it, just in time to see Henry roll out from under the bed. He gets up and starts to put his pajamas on. I lock the door.
Where were you?
I whisper.
Under the bed, Henry whispers back as though this should be obvious.
All the time?
Yeah.
For some reason, this strikes me as hilarious, and I start to giggle. Henry puts his hand over my mouth, and soon we are both shaking with laughter, silently.
Christmas Day is strangely calm after the high seas of yesterday. We gather around the tree, self-conscious in our bathrobes and slippers, and presents are opened and exclaimed over. After effusive thanks on all sides, we eat breakfast. There is a lull, and then we eat Christmas dinner, with great praise for Nell and the lobsters. Everyone is smiling, well-mannered, and good-looking. We are a model happy family, an advertisement for the bourgeoisie. We are everything I always longed for when I sat in the Lucky Wok restaurant with Dad and Mrs. and Mr. Kim every Christmas Day, and tried to pretend I was enjoying myself while the adults all watched anxiously. But even as we lounge, well-fed, in the living room after dinner, watching football on television and reading the books we have given each other, and attempting to operate the presents which require batteries and or assembly, there is a noticeable strain. It is as though somewhere in one of the more remote rooms of the house, a ceasefire has been signed, and now all the parties are endeavoring to honor it, at least until tomorrow, at least until a new consignment of ammunition comes in. We are all acting, pretending to be relaxed, impersonating the ideal mother, father, sisters, brother, boyfriend, fiancé. And so it is a relief when Claire looks at her watch, gets up off the couch, and says, "Come on, it's time to go over to Laura's."
Laura's party is in full swing by the time we arrive. Henry is tense and pale and heads for the liquor as soon as we get our coats off. I still feel sleepy from the wine we drank at dinner, so I shake my head when he asks me what I want and he brings me a Coke. He's holding on to his beer as though it's ballast.
"Do not, under any circumstances, leave me to fend for myself," Henry demands, looking over my shoulder.
And before I can even turn my head, Helen is upon us. There is a momentary, embarrassed silence.
"So, Henry," Helen says, "we hear that you are a librarian, but you don't look like a librarian."
"Actually, I am a Calvin Klein underwear model. The librarian thing is just a front."
I've never seen Helen nonplussed before. I wish I had a camera. She recovers quickly, though, looks Henry up and down, and smiles.
"Okay, Claire, you can keep him," she says.
"That's a relief," I tell her. "I've lost the receipt." Laura, Ruth, and Nancy converge on us, looking determined, and interrogate us. How did we meet? What does Henry do for a living? Where did he go to college? Blah, blah, blah. I never expected that when Henry and I finally appeared in public together, it would be simultaneously so nerve-wracking and so boring. I tune in again, just as Nancy says, "It's so weird that your name is Henry."
"Oh," says Henry. "Why's that?"
Nancy tells him about the slumber party at Mary Christina's, the one where the Ouija board said that I was going to marry someone named Henry. Henry looks impressed.
"Really?"
he asks me. Yeah. I suddenly have an urgent need to pee. "Excuse me," I say, detaching myself from the group and ignoring Henry's pleading expression. Helen is hot on my heels as I run upstairs. I have to shut the bathroom door in her face to stop her from following me in.
"Open up, Claire," she says, jiggling the doorknob.
I take my time,
pee, wash my hands, put on fresh lipstick. Claire, Helen grumbles, I'm going to go downstairs and tell your boyfriend every single hideous thing you've ever done in your life if you don't open this door immediately. I swing the door open, and Helen almost falls into the room. All right, Claire Abshire, Helen says menacingly. She closes the door. I sit down on the side of the bathtub, and she leans against the sink, looming over me in her pumps. Fess up. What is really going on with you and this Henry person? I mean, you just stood there and told a big fat stack of lies. You didn't meet this guy 3 months ago. You've known him for years. What's the big secret? I don't really know how to begin. Should I tell Helen the truth? No. Why not? As far as I know, Helen has only seen Henry once, and he didn't look that different from how he looks right now. I love Helen. She's strong, she's crazy, she's hard to fool. But I know she wouldn't believe me if I said, "Time travel, Helen, you have to see it to believe it." Okay, I say, gathering my wits. Yeah, I've known him for a long time. How long? Since I was 6. Helen's eyes bug out like a cartoon character's. I laugh. Why? How come? Well, how long have you been dating him? I don't know. I mean, there was a period of time when things were sort of on the verge, but nothing was actually going on, you know. That is, Henry was pretty adamant that he wasn't going to mess around with a little kid, so I was just kind of hopelessly nuts about him. But how come we never heard about him? I don't see why it all had to be such a hush-hush. You could have told me. Well, you kind of knew. This is lame, and I know it. Helen looks hurt. That's not the same thing as you telling me. I know. I'm sorry. So what was the deal? Well, he's 8 years older than me. So what? So when I was 12 and he was 20, that was a problem. Not to mention when I was 6 and he was 40. I still don't get it. I mean, I can see you not wanting your parents to know you were playing Lolita to his Humbert Humbert, but I don't get why you couldn't tell us. We would have been totally into it. I mean, we spent all this time feeling sorry for you and worrying about you and wondering why you were such a nun. Helen shakes her head. And there you were, screwing Mario the librarian the whole time. I can't help it. I'm blushing. I was not screwing him the whole time. Oh, come on. Really? We waited till I was 18. We did it on my birthday. Even so, Claire, Helen begins, but there's a heavy knock on the bathroom door and a deep male voice asks, Are you girls about done in there? To be continued, Helen hisses at me as we exit the bathroom to the applause of the 5 guys standing in line in the hallway. I find Henry in the kitchen, listening patiently as one of Laura's inexplicable jock friends babbles on about football. I catch the eye of his blonde, button-nosed girlfriend, and she hauls him off to get another drink. Henry says, Look, Claire, baby punks. I look, and he's pointing at Jody, Laura's 14-year-old sister, and her boyfriend, Bobby Hardgrove. Bobby has a green mohawk, and the full, ripped T-shirt, safety pin get-up, and Jody is trying to look like Lydia Lunch, but instead just looks like a raccoon having a bad hair day. Somehow they seem like they're at a Halloween party instead of a Christmas party. They look stranded and defensive, but Henry is enthusiastic. Wow, how old are they? About 12? 14. Let's see, 14 from 91, that makes them... Oh my God, they were born in 1977. I feel old, I need another drink. Laura passes through the kitchen holding a tray of Jell-O shots. Henry takes 2 and downs them both in rapid succession, then makes a face. Ugh! How revolting. I laugh. What do you think they listen to? Henry says. Dunno. Why don't you go over and ask them? Henry looks alarmed. Oh, I couldn't. I'd scare them. I think you're scared of them. Well, you may be right. They look so tender and young and green, like baby peas or something. Did you ever dress like that? Henry snorts derisively. What do you think? Of course not. Those children are emulating British punk. I am an American punk. No, I used to be into more of a Richard Hell kind of look.
Why don't you go talk to them? They seem lonely.
You have to come and introduce us and hold my hand.
We venture across the kitchen with caution, like Levi Strauss approaching a pair of cannibals. Jody and Bobby have that fight-or-flight look you see on deer on the Nature Channel.
Hi, Jody. Bobby.
Hi, Claire,
says Jody. I've known Jody her whole life, but she seems shy all of a sudden, and I decide that the neopunk apparel must be Bobby's idea. You guys looked kind of, bored, so I brought Henry over to meet you. He likes your outfits.
Hi, says Henry, acutely embarrassed. I was just curious. That is, I was wondering, what do you listen to?
Listen to? Bobby repeats.
You know, music. What music are you into?
Bobby lights up.
Well, the Sex Pistols, he says and pauses.
Of course, says Henry, nodding. In the Clash?
Yeah, and, Nirvana.
Nirvana's good, says Henry.
Blondie? Says Jody, as though her answer might be wrong.
I like Blondie, I say, and Henry likes Deborah Harry.
Ramones? Says Henry.
They nod in unison.
How about Patti Smith?
Jody and Bobby look blank.
Iggy Pop?
Bobby shakes his head.
Pearl Jam?
He offers. I intercede. We don't have much of a radio station up here, I tell Henry. There's no way for them to find out about this stuff.
Oh, Henry says. He pauses. Look, do you want me to write some things down for you to listen to?
Jody shrugs. Bobby nods, looking serious and excited. I forage for paper and pen in my purse. Henry sits down at the kitchen table, and Bobby sits across from him.
Okay, says Henry. You have to go back to the 60s, right? You start with the Velvet Underground in New York, and then right over here in Detroit, you've got the MC5 and Iggy Pop and the Stooges, and then back in New York, there were the New York Dolls and the Heartbreakers.
Tom Petty? Says Jody. We've heard of him.
No, this was a totally different band, says Henry. Most of them died in the 80s.
Plane crash? Asks Bobby.
Heroin, Henry corrects. Anyway, there was television and Richard Hell and the Voidoids and Patti Smith.
Talking Heads, I add.
Huh? I don't know. Would you really consider them punk?
They were there.
Okay. Henry adds them to his list. Talking Heads. So then things move over to England.
I thought punk started in London, says Bobby.
No.
Of course, says Henry, pushing back his chair.
Some people, me included, believe that punk is just the most recent manifestation of this, this spirit, this feeling, you know, that things aren't right and that, in fact, things are so wrong that the only thing we can do is to say fuck it over and over again really loud until someone stops us.
Yes, Bobby says quietly, his face glowing with an almost religious fervor under his spiked hair.
Yes.
You're corrupting a minor, I tell Henry.
Oh, he would get there anyway without me, wouldn't you?
I've been trying, but it ain't easy here.
I can appreciate that, says Henry.
He's adding to the list. I look over his shoulder. Sex Pistols, The Clash, Gang of Four, Buzzcocks, Dead Kennedys, X, The Mekons, The Raincoats, The Dead Boys, New Order, The Smiths, Laura Logic, The O'Pairs, Big Black, P.I.L., The Pixies, The Breeders, Sonic Youth.
Henry, they're not going to be able to get any of that up here.
He nods and jots the phone number and address for Vintage Vinyl at the bottom of the sheet.
You do have a record player, right?
My parents have one, Bobby says. Henry winces.
What do you really like? I ask Jody. I feel as though she's fallen out of the conversation during the male bonding ritual Henry and Bobby are conducting.
Prince, she admits.
Henry and I let out a big woo, and I start singing 1999 as loud as I can, and Henry jumps up and we're doing a bump and grind across the kitchen. Laura hears us and runs off to put the actual record on, and just like that, it's a dance party.
We're driving back to Claire's parents' house from Laura's party. Claire says, "You're awfully quiet." I was thinking about those kids, the baby punks. Oh, yeah? What about them? I was trying to figure out what would cause that kid, Bobby, to revert, to latch on to music that was made the year he was born. Well, I was really into the Beatles, Claire points out. They broke up the year before I was born. Yeah, well, what is that about? I mean,
You should have been swooning over Depeche Mode or Sting or somebody. Bobby and his girlfriend ought to be listening to The Cure if they want to dress up. But instead, they've stumbled into this thing, punk, that they don't know anything about. I'm sure it's mostly to annoy their parents. Laura was telling me that her dad won't let Jody leave the house dressed like that. She puts everything in her backpack and changes in the ladies' room at school, says Claire. But that's what everybody did back when. I mean, it's about asserting your individualism. I understand that. But why are they asserting the individualism of 1977? They ought to be wearing plaid flannel. Why do you care? Claire says. It depresses me. It's a reminder that the moment I belong to is dead, and not just dead, but forgotten. None of this stuff ever gets played on the radio. I can't figure out why. It's like it never happened. That's why I get excited when I see little kids pretending to be punks, because I don't want it all to just disappear. Well, says Clara, you can always go back. Most people are glued to the present. You get to be there again and again. I think about this. It's just sad, Claire. Even when I get to do something cool, like, say, go to see a concert I missed the first time around, maybe a band that's broken up or somebody that died, it's sad watching them because I know what's going to happen. But how is that different from the rest of your life? It isn't. We've reached the private road that leads to Claire's house. She turns in.
Henry?
Yeah?
If you could stop now, if you could not time travel anymore and there would be no consequences, would you?
If I could stop now and still meet you?
You've already met me.
Yes, I would stop. I glance at Claire, dim in the dark car.
It would be funny, she says. I would have all these memories that you would never get to have. It would be like, well, it is like being with somebody who has amnesia.
I've been feeling that way ever since we got here. I laugh. So in the future you can watch me lurch along into each memory until I've got the complete set, collect them all?
She smiles. I guess so.
Claire pulls into the circular driveway in front of the house.
Home sweet home.
Later, after we have crept upstairs into our separate rooms and I have put on pajamas and brushed my teeth and sneaked into Claire's room and remembered to lock the door this time, and we are warm in her narrow bed, she whispers,
I wouldn't want you to miss it.
Miss what?
All the things that happened when I was a kid. I mean, so far they have only halfway happened because you aren't there yet. So when they happen to you, then it's real.
I'm on my way. I run my hand over her belly and down between her legs.
Claire squeals. Shh! Your hand is icy.
Sorry. We fuck carefully, silently. When I finally come, it's so intense that I get a horrible headache. And for a minute I'm afraid I'm going to disappear, but I don't. Instead, I lie in Claire's arms, cross-eyed with pain. Claire snores, quiet animal snores that feel like bulldozers running through my head.
I want my own bed in my own apartment. Home sweet home. No place like home. Take me home, country roads. Home is where the heart is, but my heart is here, so I must be home.
Claire sighs, turns her head, and is quiet.
Hi, honey. I'm home. I'm home.
It's a clear, cold morning. Breakfast has been eaten. The car is packed. Mark and Sharon have already left with Daddy for the airport in Kalamazoo. Henry is in the hall saying goodbye to Alicia. I run upstairs to Mama's room. Oh, is it so late? She asks when she sees me wearing my coat and boots. I thought you were staying to lunch. Mama is sitting at her desk, which as always is covered with pieces of paper, which are covered with her extravagant handwriting. What are you working on? Whatever it is, it's full of scratched out words and doodles.
Mama turns the page face down. She's very secretive about her writing.
Nothing. It's a poem about the garden under the snow. It isn't coming out well at all.
Mama stands up, walks to the window. Funny how poems are never as nice as the real garden. My poems, anyway. I can't really comment on this because Mama has never let me read one of her poems, so I say, well, the garden is beautiful. And she waves the compliment away. Praise means nothing to Mama. She doesn't believe it. Only criticism can flush her cheeks and catch her attention. If I were to say something disparaging, she would remember it always. There is an awkward pause. I realize that she is waiting for me to leave so she can go back to her writing. Bye, Mama, I say. I kiss her cool face and escape.
We've been on the road for about an hour. For miles, the highway was bordered by pine trees. Now we are in flat land full of barbed wire fences. Neither of us has spoken in a while. As soon as I notice it, the silence is strange, and so I say something. That wasn't so bad. My voice is too cheerful, too loud in the small car. Claire doesn't answer, and I look over at her. She's crying. Tears are running down her cheeks as she drives, pretending that she's not crying. I've never seen Claire cry before, and something about her silent, stoic tears unnerves me. Claire? Claire, maybe... could you maybe pull over for a minute? Without looking at me, she slows down and drives onto the shoulder, stops. We are somewhere in Indiana. The sky is blue, and there are many crows in the field at the side of the road. Claire leans her forehead against the steering wheel and takes a long, ragged breath. Claire. I'm talking to the back of her head. Claire, I'm sorry. Did I fuck up somehow? What happened? It's not you, she says under her veil of hair. We sit like this for minutes. What's wrong, then? Claire shakes her head, and I sit and stare at her. Finally, I gather enough courage to touch her. I stroke her hair, feeling the bones of her neck and spine through the thick, shimmering waves. She turns, and I am holding her awkwardly across the divided seats, and now Claire is crying hard, shuddering. Then she's quiet. Then she says, "God damn, Mama." Later, we are sitting in a traffic jam on the Dan Ryan Expressway listening to Irma Thomas. Henry, did you mind very much? Mind what, I ask, thinking about Claire crying. But she says, my family? They were fine, Claire. I really liked them, especially Alicia. Sometimes I just want to push them all into Lake Michigan and watch them sink. I know the feeling. Hey, I think your dad and your brother have seen me before. And Alicia said something really strange just as we were leaving. I saw you with Dad and Mark once. And Alicia definitely saw you in the basement one day when she was 12. Is that going to be a problem? No, because the explanation is too weird to be believed. We both laugh, and the tension that has ridden with us all the way to Chicago dissipates. Traffic begins to accelerate. Soon Claire stops in front of my apartment building. I take my bag from the trunk, and I watch as Claire pulls away and glides down Dearborn, and my throat closes up. Hours later, I identify what I am feeling as loneliness. And Christmas is officially over for another year. Home is anywhere you hang your head. Saturday, May 9th, 1992. Henry is 28. I've decided that the best strategy is to just ask straight out. Either he says yes or no. I take the Ravenswood L to Dad's apartment, the home of my youth. I haven't been here much lately. Dad seldom invites me over, and I'm not given to showing up unannounced, the way I'm about to do. But if he won't answer his phone, what does he expect?
I get off at Western and walk west on Lawrence. The two flat is on Virginia. The back porch looks over the Chicago River. As I stand in the foyer fumbling for my key, Mrs. Kim peeps out of her door and furtively gestures for me to step in. I am alarmed. Kimmy is usually very hearty and loud and affectionate, and although she knows everything there is to know about us, she never interferes. Well, almost never. Actually, she gets pretty involved in our lives, but we like it. I sense that she is really upset.
You like a Coke?
She's already marching toward her kitchen. Sure. I set my backpack by the front door and follow her. In the kitchen, she cracks the metal lever of an old-fashioned ice cube tray. I always marvel at Kimmy's strength. She must be 70, and to me, she seems exactly the same as when I was little. I spent a lot of time down here helping her make dinner for Mr. Kim, who died 5 years ago, reading, doing homework, and watching TV. I sit at the kitchen table, and she sets a glass of Coke brimming with ice before me. She has a half-consumed cup of instant coffee in one of the bone china cups with hummingbirds painted around the rim. I remember the first time she allowed me to drink coffee out of one of those cups. I was 13. I felt like a grown-up.
Long time no see, buddy. Ouch. I know.
I'm sorry. Time has been moving kind of fast lately. She appraises me. Kimmy has piercing black eyes, which seem to see the very back of my brain. Her flat Korean face conceals all emotion, unless she wants you to see it. She is a fantastic bridge player.
You been time traveling?
No, in fact, I haven't been anywhere for months. It's been great.
You got a girlfriend?
I grin.
Ho ho, okay. I know all about it. What's her name? How come you don't bring her around?
Her name is Claire. I have offered to bring her around several times, and he always turns me down.
You don't offer to me? You come here, Richard will come too. We have Duck Amandine.
As usual, I am impressed with my own obtusity. Mrs. Kim knows the perfect way to dissolve all social difficulties. My dad feels no compunction about being a jerk to me, but he will always make an effort for Mrs. Kim. As well he should, since she pretty much raised his child and probably isn't charging him market rent.
You're a genius. Yes, I am. How come I don't get a MacArthur grant, I ask you?
Dunno. Maybe you're not getting out of the house enough. I don't think the MacArthur people are hanging out at Bingo World.
No, they already got enough money. So, when you getting married?
Coke comes up my nose, I'm laughing so hard. Kimmy lurches up and starts thumping me on the back. I subside, and she sits back down, grumpily.
What's so funny? I'm just asking. I get to ask, huh?
No, that's not it. I mean, I'm not laughing because it's ludicrous. I'm laughing because you are reading my mind. I came over to ask Dad to let me have Mom's rings.
Oh, boy. I don't know. Wow, you're getting married. Hey, that's great. She gonna say yes?
I think so. I'm 99% sure.
Well, that's pretty good. I don't know about your mom's rings, though. See, what I want to tell you...
Her eyes glance at the ceiling.
Your dad, he's not doing too good. He's yelling a lot and throwing stuff, and he's not practicing.
Oh. Well, that's not totally surprising, but it's not good. You been up there lately? Kimmy is ordinarily in Dad's apartment a lot. I think she surreptitiously cleans it. I've seen her defiantly ironing Dad's tucked shirts, daring me to comment.
He won't let me in.
She's on the verge of tears. This is very bad. My dad certainly has his problems, but it is monstrous of him to let them affect Kimmy. But when he's not there? Usually, I pretend not to know that Kimmy is in and out of Dad's apartment without his knowledge. She pretends that she would never do such a thing, but actually, I'm appreciative, now that I no longer live here. Someone has to keep an eye on him. She looks guilty and crafty and slightly alarmed that I'm mentioning this.
Okay. Yeah, I go in once, 'cause I worry about him. He's got trash everywhere. We're gonna get bugs if he keep this up. He's got nothing in that fridge but beer and lemons. He got so much clothes on the bed, I don't think he sleeps in it. I don't know what he's doing. I never seen him this bad since when your mom died.
Oh, boy. What do you think? There is a big crash above our heads, which means Dad has dropped something on the kitchen floor. He's probably just getting up. I guess I better go up there.
Yeah.
Kimmy is wistful.
He's such a nice guy, your dad. I don't know why he lets it get like this.
He's an alcoholic. That's what alcoholics do. It's in their job description, fall apart and then keep falling apart. She levels her devastating gaze at me.
Speaking of jobs...
Yes? Oh, shit.
I don't think he's been working.
Well, it's the off-season. He doesn't work in May.
They are touring Europe, and he's here. Also, he don't pay rent last 2 months.
Damn, damn, damn.
Kimmy, why didn't you call me? That's awful. Jeez.
I'm on my feet and down the hall. I grab my backpack and return to the kitchen. I delve around in it and find my checkbook. How much does he owe you? Mrs. Kim is deeply embarrassed.
No, Henry, don't. He'll pay it.
He can pay me back. Come on, buddy, it's okay. Cough it out. Now, how much? She's not looking at me.
$1,200,
she says in a small voice. That's all? What are you doing, buddy, running the Philanthropic Society for the support of wayward the Tambles? I write the check and stick it under her saucer. You better cash that or I'll come looking for you.
Well, then I won't cash it, and you will have to visit me.
I'll visit you anyway. I am utterly guilt-stricken. I will bring Claire. Kimmy beams at me.
I hope so. I'm going to be your maid of honor, right?
If Dad doesn't shape up, you can give me away. Actually, that's a great idea. You can walk me down the aisle, and Claire will be waiting in her tux, and the organist will be playing Lohengrin.
I better buy a dress.
Yow! Don't buy any dresses until I tell you it's a done deal. I sigh. I guess I better go up there and talk to him. I stand up. In Mrs. Kim's kitchen, I feel enormous. Suddenly, as though I'm visiting my old grammar school and marveling over the size of the desks. She stands slowly and follows me to the front door. I hug her. For a moment, she seems fragile and lost. And I wonder about her life, the telescoping days of cleaning and gardening and bridge playing. But then my own concerns crash back in again. I will come back soon. I can't spend my entire life hiding in bed with Claire. Kimmy watches as I open Dad's door. Hey, Dad, you home? There's a pause, and then, go away! I walk up the stairs, and Mrs. Kim shuts her door. The first thing that hits me is the smell. Something is rotting in here. The living room is devastated. Where are all the books? My parents had tons of books on music, on history, novels, in French, in German, in Italian. Where are they? Even the record and CD collection seems smaller. There are papers all over. Junk mail, newspapers, scores, covering the floor. My mother's piano is coated with dust, and there is a vase of long-dead gladiolas mummifying on the windowsill. I walk down the hall, glancing in the bedrooms. Utter chaos. Clothes, garbage, more newspapers. In the bathroom, a bottle of Michelob lies under the sink, and a glossy, dry layer of beer varnishes the tile. In the kitchen, my father sits at the table with his back to me, looking out the window at the river. He doesn't turn around as I enter. He doesn't look at me when I sit down.
But he doesn't get up and leave either, so I take it as a sign that conversation may proceed. Hi, Dad. Silence. I saw Mrs. Kim just now. She says you're not doing too good. Silence. I hear you're not working.
It's May.
How come you're not on tour?
He finally looks at me.
Under the stubbornness, there is fright.
I'm on sick leave.
Since when?
March.
Paid sick leave? Silence. Are you sick? What's wrong? I think he's going to ignore me, but then he answers by holding out his hands. They are shaking as though they are in their own tiny earthquake.
He's done it. Finally.
23 years of determined drinking, and he's destroyed his ability to play the violin. Oh, Dad. Oh, God. What does Stan say?
He says that's it.
The nerves are shot, and they aren't coming back.
Jesus.
We look at each other for an